Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, check out all the articles and other things that we are publishing. And go over to the YouTube, type in 1517, and subscribe to the YouTube channel because we're putting all the videos up there. We have new videos coming out all the time. Table talks, addressing theological issues, apologetic issues, practical issues. We've done a couple of series, one on the Formula of Concord, one on the Decalogue, and we are about to start producing another one that is going to be YouTube-only content. I won't tell you what it's about. Oh, wait, yes, I will. It's Scott Keith, Bruce Hillman, and myself, and we're going to be answering questions about Christianity and postmodernism. Ooh. Yeah, so ooh. If you're interested in that sort of thing, we'll be putting those up probably starting next week, the week after this releases. We're recording some of those this week, so check those out. Just subscribe to the YouTube channel, ring the bell so you don't miss any of it. That's how you do that. Also, if you want to, you know, in this time, if you got time on your hands, I don't know, maybe some of you went back to work. Even if you did go back to work, you still got time to rate and review the podcast. Go over to iTunes, give it that 5-star review. Give it that rating. We'd love to have it. All right, Eric. We are in Luke chapter 20.
We are. We're in the midst of Passion Week. Dan, by the way, you know, your intro each week reminds me that if this podcast gig doesn't work out, you know, this 1517 gig doesn't work out, you, my friend, could go into auctioneering.
Hey.
You lead that auction. Dude, you can do it. Impressive.
Game show host,
you could do that too. I'm always impressed. You're able to get out all this info so quickly.
Well, I try.
It's a marvel of modern man.
Here's what I actually try to do. I try to get into what we're doing by the 2.5 minute mark. That's what I try
and
to
usually
do.
We're able to do it.
Usually we're able to do it. So I try to get through all that stuff quick, but I want people to know what's going on. So.
Yeah, people get to, you know, the details, but they want to get to the word, man. They want to get to the good stuff.
Speaking of which, we're at the 2.5 minute mark.
There we are. We did it. So we're in Luke chapter 20, as you mentioned. And, you know, just to bring you up to speed, you know, Jesus has just entered the holy city of Jerusalem, you know, with his triumphal entry. First it was the triumphal entry. Then it was him weeping over Jerusalem's continual rejection of God and his plans for them. Then he goes in and cleanses the temple. And so what we noted last time is Jesus is really like he's picking a fight. Like he is clearly, coming to the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the corrupt religious establishment and saying, I'm here to overturn things. What you've done to my father's house is not acceptable. And I'm here to claim this place as my own. I'm here to claim the worship of God being directed by me. And so that's really what you're going to see fleshed out for you today in Luke chapter 20. You're going to see a bunch of challenges brought to Jesus based on some of the actions he's done thus far. And so with that as context, it reads like this, chapter 20, verse 1. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, the chief priests and the scribes with the elders came up and said to him, "Tell us, by what authority you do these things, or who it is that gave you this authority?"
I like that he's just cleansed the temple, and now he's preaching the gospel in the temple. This is good.
I mean, yeah, not only does he cleanse the temple, he takes over the teaching ministry of the temple.
Yes, like, it's like he's taking this thing over.
He is now the de facto pastor of this place. And so you can imagine how upsetting this is for the religious establishment to see him do this. And by the way, when they ask him, like, by what authority you're doing this, what they're alluding to was something that would happen back then where usually if you were going to teach in a synagogue or something like that, or another rabbi would give you some sort of certificate or some sort of, writing that what you could hand off to those who were in charge of that place to show that you had the authority to bring the word that day.
Yeah, and this is a question that they have, like, they have concocted up. So they are sitting around thinking, okay, we need to, like, try to squash this out. Now, what exactly is it that we're going to say to him? Because they've done this a couple of times, and it hasn't gone well. So you know that this isn't just, like, off the cuff. Like, they're going to come up with something they can ask him that they think they can trap him with.
Yeah. And, you know, Jesus could have responded very legitimately, I do this on the authority of my father. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had just gotten done saying, you have turned my father's house into, you know, a den of robbers. I mean, so it's not as if he hasn't claimed this mantle of authority before, but instead of doing that, he chooses to turn the tables on them. Or as Michael Scott would say, how he table turned them. So he answered them, I also will ask you a question. Now tell me, was the baptism of John from heaven or from man? And they discussed it with one another, saying, if we say from heaven, he will say, why did you not believe him? But if we say from man, all the people will stone us to death, for they are convinced that John was a prophet. So they answered that they did not know where it came from. And Jesus said to them, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things.
Yeah. So they are answering dishonestly, first of all, because they do have an opinion. They do not think that this authority came from God.
That is correct. They did not agree with John's ministry.
No. And so since this is the case, Jesus traps them and says, look, I'm not going to get in a debate with people who are going to debate dishonestly. This is not a good faith question, in other words.
Yeah. He knows they're trying to trap him. He knows that they want to do something to get in his way and to put a stumbling block before him. And so, you know, it's clear from their response here that they're playing politics, and they're too afraid of the people to say what they really believe. And yet at the same time, if they do give John the seal of approval, then that will go against what they've done in the past and what they've said in the past. And so, you know, their answer is like, well, we don't know. And Jesus then, you say, okay, fine. I'm not going to tell you either.
Yep.
You don't have the boldness to go and make your statement clear, then I'm not going to play this game with you.
He's essentially saying, if you won't acknowledge John, you're not going to acknowledge me, showing their fear of man, too.
That's right. I mean, this whole chapter, he's going to be exposing them. As he shows, indeed, his authority, one of the ways he's going to show his authority over them is he's going to, well, basically own them in a number of different situations. He's going to embarrass them. And so that continues in that vein, verse 9, and he began to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard and let it out to tenants and went into another country for a long while. When the time came, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent another servant, but they also beat and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent yet a third. This one also they wounded and cast out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, what shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him. But when the tenants saw him, they said to themselves, this is the heir. Let us kill him so that the inheritance may be ours. And they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When they heard this, they said, surely not. But he looked directly at them and said, what then is this that is written? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. And when it falls on anyone, it will crush him. I mean, if we could sort of sum it up, and we'll, you know, break it apart a little bit here, Dan, but really, this is kind of an exposition of the entire story of the Old Testament.
Yep.
I mean, what he's doing is he's likening the religious establishment to people that God has sort of let oversee his vineyard, that the owner has let oversee. And, you know, periodically throughout Old Testament history, he sends people to check on it. These would be the prophets. And what does the religious establishment do with the prophets whenever they come to check on what's going on in the vineyard? Well, they beat him up. They treat him harshly. They kill him. That's, I mean, so much of the history of the Old Testament.
Yep.
And this all, of course, culminates with the killing of the son.
Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting that he's saying this right on the heels of asking the question about John the Baptist, because, of course, John the Baptist is the last and greatest prophet, right?
Yeah.
This is certainly what they did with him, rejected him. He ended up being killed, not by them, but they certainly did not oppose it. This response is interesting, right? He's like, what will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. And it says when they heard this, they said, surely not. Now, this might take a little exegesis. What are they saying surely not to here? Now, they could be saying, surely he won't destroy them and give it to somebody else if they're understanding what it is, the picture that he's painting. They could be saying, surely he will not take it away from the Jews and give it to someone else. They could be saying that. Or they could be saying, surely not to the whole story. Like, surely this wouldn't happen. Surely they wouldn't kill all the messengers and then even kill his son. Surely not.
Yeah.
We're not entirely sure which thing that they're objecting to here.
Yeah, what we do know is that they don't like what they've heard because they are clearly aware that Jesus is indicting them for their poor leadership over the vineyard and over, God's people. And, there is, of course, this allusion here that certainly in many, many cases, is seen as a promise that this vineyard is no longer going to be, it's not going to be exclusive to Israel, that it's going to go beyond that. It's going to also be given to the Gentiles. And, people have said that. But either way, if they're saying surely not to no, that would never happen. That also is something they did. They would downplay and minimize, the history of Israel. And, they'd find reasons to sort of rationalize what they did. And Jesus just won't allow that. He's calling them out on it.
Yeah. And then says, oh, really? Surely not? Then what does this mean? As it is written that the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone.
Yeah, they're clearly aware that Jesus is making a messianic claim here because everyone understood that this is a reference to a messianic passage cited from Psalm 118, verse 22. So they know what he's saying and they know what he's promising. They don't like it. And so here come more challenges. Verse 19, the scribes and the chief priests sought to lay hands on him at that very hour, for they perceived that he had told this parable against them. I love that. You think so?
that's some keen awareness.
Yes, that's right. But of course, even though they wanted to get rid of him, they feared the people. Second time you see this.
This is fascinating. The scribes and chief priests sought to lay hands on him at that very hour. I could insert in here, to literally fulfill the parable that Jesus had just told, for they perceived that he had been talking about them. They're like, what is this outrage? I say we do exactly what he just said we would do right now.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it is a great example of sort of spiritual blindness at play, right? I mean, they because they're fulfilling the very story in the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's this idea that you could see and not see at the same time. Or it's like, They see enough to know he's talking about us. They don't see enough to understand, yeah, he is talking about you. Are you going to go and do that thing now? Like that's yeah. Pretty bizarre, man.
Yeah. And so it reads, verse 20, so they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be sincere that they might catch him in something he said so as to deliver him up to the authority and jurisdiction of the governor. So they asked him, teacher, we know that you speak and teach rightly and show no partiality, but truly teach the way of God.
That is gross.
It's icky, buttering man. Him up, going to try and find a way to get him to soften his tone towards them. And so the question, is it lawful for us to give tribute to Caesar or not?
And they're just trying to come up with all the questions to get this guy in a bind, aren't they?
Well, this would have been a truly, truly controversial question, right? I mean, this was on the minds of so many in Jerusalem, because on the one hand, most people did not like giving tribute to Caesar and felt that it was unjust the way that the tax collectors would come at them and take more money than they should. And so there was this movement of what were called zealots, that really tried to fight the Roman occupation. One of the ways was by resisting paying this tribute to Caesar. But and so so but they know if Jesus is, so if he stands against that, then he could be unpopular with those people, with those zealots. If he stands up for giving tribute to Caesar, then he's going to be, or he stands against giving tribute to Caesar, then he's going to be in trouble with the Roman authorities. This is the trap they're trying to make for him.
Yep.
They're trying to drive a wedge between the people and the Roman authorities so that they can find a reason to have him arrested. And indeed, they do bring this up later. They do bring up Caesar later because he claims to be the king of the Jews. And they say, see, he's claiming to have the authority that only should be Caesar's. So this is the sort of method to their madness here. Verse 23, but he perceived their craftiness and said to them, show me a denarius whose likeness and inscription does it have? They said, Caesar's. He said to them, then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. And they were not able in the presence of the people to catch him in what he said, but marveling at his answer, they became silent.
So this is to say that this money did not have "In God We Trust" written on it.
That is correct. And you know, this is a subtle way of Jesus saying the image on the coin is Caesar's image. And so you give that which has his image to him. But the image on you is God's image.
Yep.
And you give that to God. I mean, Jesus says, basically, yeah, pay your taxes, but don't give your allegiance to Caesar.
Right.
Don't give your ultimate allegiance to Caesar. Give your ultimate allegiance to the one whose image you're made in.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is a brilliant response, because what he's doing is you just see him like looking at a coin and sort of being like, this is the source of the conflict. Mm-hmm. This guy's face is on this.
Yeah.
And you're asking me, should we give it to him? So he's exposing all kinds of things. He's exposing idolatry. He's exposing the idea that they would think that this is the great injustice, that they would be asked to pay taxes to Caesar with money.
Yeah.
And he's saying, what he's saying, yeah, is exactly this, like, give him the money. Don't give him your worship, though.
Yeah. Now in the context here, this is just answering a question that they're posing to him. And so he sort of throws back their trap on them. But it is probably important to note, Dan, how much Jesus's answer has been used throughout Western civilization's history to defend the idea that there is a place for the state and there is a place for the church. There are two kingdoms. And this is one of those passages that sort of shows that both things can exist. God is over both of them, but they are different spheres.
Yep. Yeah. Right and left hand, as Luther called them.
That's right. And so this is what, I mean, this passage is actually, if you look at the early documents of, you know, the Federalist Papers and that kind of thing in the founding of America, you'll hear this kind of passage bandied about. You'll hear this used as a reference point for how to understand the role of government. So they're not done. They've still got more testing to do. They, you know, first pitch, swing and a miss. I mean, they blew it. So there came to him some Sadducees, those who deny that there is a resurrection. So notice, I mean, the first group was the scribes and chief priests. The next group are some Sadducees. Not necessarily the same people.
Yeah, no, coming in in waves. They're united in one thing. They don't like this guy who's messing up the whole religious enterprise here. So mm-hmm. They send in one group, swing and a miss. Here comes group number two. Let's see if they can do better.
And they asked him, verse 28, a question, saying, "Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies having a wife but no children, the man must take the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers. The first took a wife and died without children. And the second and the third took her. And likewise, all seven left no children and died. Afterward, the woman also died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will the woman be? For the seven had her as a wife."
Yeah, so one thing that's interesting about this is actually, while not in the Old Testament, is probably referring to a pretty famous Jewish story. I believe this is in the book of Tobit, where this story takes place. But this isn't sort of a story that they made up that was unfamiliar. So this is an actual Hebrew story.
Right.
Whether it's true or not, don't know that, but it's definitely something that that people were familiar with. What's what's interesting about this question is they're asking them a question about something that they don't even believe in.
That's right. This is something that they're trying to get him. Again, who are they trying to? They're trying to create a wedge between those who do believe in a resurrection and those who don't. And so they want Jesus to try and they want to force him onto a side. And what Jesus will do is drop some straight up great exegesis on them that they don't have an answer for.
Yep.
And Jesus said to them, the sons of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy to attain to that age and to the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, for they cannot die anymore because they are equal to angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. But that the dead are raised, even Moses showed in the passage about the bush where he calls the Lord the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. Now he is not God of the dead, but of the living, for all live to him. Then some of the scribes answered, Teacher, you have spoken well. But they no longer dared to ask him any question.
That might have been like the best response to getting owned out of all the ownings we've seen, where they say they're basically like, touche. That's a good answer right there.
Yeah. Now initially you might go, well, how does he prove that God is the God of the living from that passage that he quotes when he says, where he calls the Lord the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob? Well, the short answer is, he doesn't say, I was the God of Abraham.
Right.
I was the God of Isaac. I was the God of Jacob. He says, I am.
Mm-hmm.
Presently.
Yep. That's exactly right. And basically, the question about marriage gets blown up when they're like, whose wife will she be? And he's like, nobody's. There ain't no marriage in the resurrection, man.
Yeah. Now, this is obviously, Dan, with our sort of, more Western notions of romantic love and marriage, we are prone to thinking that marriage is for eternity. We're sort of, that sometimes is, it's talked about that way, but this is a pretty clear passage that says, no, and the reason why is not because, God is sort of against us, having a spouse. No. It's just that when we get to the kingdom of God, all of us will be united to Christ in marriage.
It's weird because, even within, Orthodox Christianity, there's still a lot of soulmate talk floating around. People buy into this sort of, God's got this one person for you kind of stuff. And there is this sort of thing where you think you're just two souls that are destined to be together forever. But that's not how this is going to work.
No, that's... Yeah, and for some, of course, this is a bit of a bubble bursting, but... Jesus is pretty clear here that that's not the way this works.
Yeah, which is a hard thing to wrap your head around. I think even for us, Eric, you're like, really? Like, so it's not like me and my wife aren't going to be me and my wife in the resurrection.
Yeah, I can't picture that.
No, it's weird.
Yeah, I can't picture, knowing her and not being married to her, mm-hmm.
But it makes a lot of sense when you think like, that makes sense when you're, we're going to be united to Christ in that way. Also makes sense in this way, like somebody dies and they get remarried and then you got a real dilemma on your hands in the resurrection, right?
Yeah. 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 And that's really what they were poking at here, because their assumption was that that would be the problem with such a doctrine. And Jesus just wipes that to the side and says, no, that's not the issue. And so we move on to verse 41, but he said to them, how can they say that the Christ is David's son? For David himself says in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. David thus calls him Lord. So how is he his son? And there Jesus finally gives them the answer to the question by whose authority he does what he does.
Yeah, he is the son of David and also the God of David.
That's right. He is Lord of Lords. And so they know exactly what he's saying here. They know exactly what he's claiming here. There's no riddles. There's no hiding behind anything. He's making it abundantly clear that this is why he has the authority to stand up and teach and preach in the in what they saw as their temple. It's not their temple. It's not their people. It's God's temple and it's God's people.
Yeah, this, I mean, this is the part of Christ that is just, I think, is just awesome to sit and contemplate for a second. When you think he's the son of David, he is also David's God. He is the son of Mary. He is also Mary's God. This is the wonder of the incarnation.
Yeah. And that's what you see on full display here.
Yeah, it's pretty great. And they would have understood this. I mean, they being the son of David, they knew the Messiah was going to come to David through David. That was, yeah, that was for sure was going to happen. But he brings up this question to them. Like, I think you might be looking at this Messiah thing all wrong.
Yeah, they did not. I mean, and they really did not see that. They really were not aware of how this was all going to work. They just didn't have, they didn't really have a concept of God coming in the flesh like this. Mm-hmm. That wasn't in their, it wasn't quite developed like that. And so this being presented to them this way is, oh, it's jarring to them.
Yeah, they thought a Messiah was going to come and he'd be like a second David, but he'd be like this anointed one. And you can understand, yeah, why you would get this from Messiah. He's, mm-hmm, the anointed one of God, but
sure,
it's different than that, where Jesus is saying he's the anointed one of God, as in designated from the dawn of existence, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the one who has...
One always, higher than David.
Yes, it has always been the case. The one who, mm-hmm, is anointed, the one who is sanctified, the one who is set apart for this work is none other than God.
That's right. And he's the only one that is qualified to be able to die for the sins of the entire world.
Right.
Which is what he's heading towards any moment. And so we wrap up the chapter here. And in the hearing of all the people, he said to his disciples, "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and love greetings in the marketplaces and the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation." If it wasn't clear before, it's abundantly clear now.
Yeah.
Jesus is here to clean house, and he's not afraid who he offends in the process of doing that.
It's interesting how the scribes and the chief priests come after him. They get blown up. Technically, that was the more orthodox group.
Right.
So he sort of instructs the Sadducees, and they sort of at least are willing to accept the instruction as something to think about. They said they answered well. They're like, good points.
Mm-hmm.
You have to think about that. Then he turns back to the scribes, and these are the people that he has, I mean, these are the people he has a real, real problem with, right? Is the people who are the main show in town, like the people that are supposed to be the orthodox. Beware of these men.
Well, what does he say they do? I mean, it's, you know, it's not just the walking around in long robes and, you know, getting all the greetings and stuff, but what does it result in? Devouring of widows' houses. I mean, like, so he accuses them of basically fleecing the poor and the needy and the people at that time that would have had the most needs in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He says, you take advantage of these people. You take advantage of the weak.
Yeah. I mean, it's good. I mean, and then for pretense, make long prayers. So this is where praying becomes a performance. I mean, fortunately, yeah, we don't have any of that anymore. That's just that's just gone away.
I've never come across that before, Dan. Never.
No. Prancing around in long robes.
We'll just, yeah,
leave that there. I'm sure that's gone the way of the buffalo as well. Yeah. But and this is a very sobering thing that he says here. He says that they will receive the greater condemnation. Greater than who? Now, I will argue that he's actually saying greater than the Sadducees, who he just talked to.
Yeah, I think contextually that makes great sense.
Mm-hmm. The ones who listen to what he said, even though they're theologically not the orthodox group, he goes back to the scribes and says, man, the condemnation on these guys who appear to be orthodox is extremely great because of what all they're doing.
Yeah, because it's complete hypocrisy.
The majority of them would think that the Sadducees were far worse than the scribes. They're sort of like,
right,
oh,
because
man, they're heterodox, man. Like they're like, yeah, because the Sadducees was a much smaller group too. And they're like, I don't know, man. They're kind of
and they were the political animals. I mean, they were the compromisers. Mm-hmm. You know, the other ones weren't. Other ones were stalwart in confessing the right doctrine.
Yeah, and what Jesus, and I think this is exactly what Jesus says. Like, yeah, I know you might think that these guys are the condemnation for these Sadducees is greater than that of the scribes and the chief priests. Wrong.
Yeah. And this is ultimately why Jesus comes, right? Jesus comes to restore the widows whose homes have been destroyed by the hypocrisy of the religious leadership. But he also comes and will even die for those who deserve the greater condemnation.
Well, the greatest condemnation is going to fall on Christ, who comes to die for sins of poor widows, arrogant scribes, and heterodox Sadducees. All right, man, that is it. We are out of time. We will see you guys next week for Luke chapter 21.